Any person who's entered the material world and is becoming conditioned by material energy, basic attitude toward life is that this world is meant for our exploitation. The material energy, matter, and other people, our attitude toward them is they're to be used for our own enjoyment, for our own advancement, aggrandizement. This is the exploitative basic material mentality. The value of the social system that's established by the Vedic literature is that this Varnashram system brings that exploitative tendency under control. So that people, despite their materialistic, despite their material desires, they can avoid becoming degraded into a lower status of life. Human beings can remain human beings and not become animals. And they can also actually make progress. There are different steps on the ladder. In the ashram system of sannyasi is the top ladder. In the varna counterpart of the system, the brahman is the top ladder, the top of the ladder. The best class of human being is the brahman, because he's more than the others, free from this exploitative tendency. But the system is so designed that all the participants are equally getting benefit and making advancement. A Shudra may have a very materialistic mentality, but he's kept under control. The virtue of a Shudra is that he accepts authority. He works under authority. He is not independent. If a devotee thinks, you know, I can't make it as a Brahmin, I've decided I'm going to be a Shudra. But you can't be a Shudra if you're independent. You're not even qualified as a Shudra if you want to remain act independently. So even the Shudra, even to be a Shudra in the Vedic system is a glorious position. A Shudra is somebody who's making advancement toward perfection. We shouldn't think that we're Vaishnavas, and for us to get involved with these material designations is a step down. We may be Vaishnavas by virtue of the mercy that's been given to us for being engaged in pure devotional service, but still, in many cases, everybody's an individual, in many cases we haven't completely given up our material conditioning yet, and many of us come from a background where our material conditioning is pretty bad. So it's not really for us to become proper Brahmins or even Kshatriyas or even Vaishyas. It's not a step down. It's actually for us, practically, it's a step up. Anyway, by ye, comment.
If they get somehow afflicted, they should come in the Manashya system on the level of the Shudra.
You mean average, common people, ordinary people?
Yeah,
it's just the Manashya. Oh, I see. People who are outside the system, outcasts. Yes? Yes. Well, you know, Prabhupada wanted first Brahmins. It's not that Prabhupada didn't have a broader vision to engage people, even people who can't function as Brahmins. I mean, they can't follow the regular principles. He wanted to engage them also. So, you know, even early on, he developed a life membership program, which is not just for collecting money. You know, Prabhupada's concept of life membership was not just a means of getting a lot of money so he could build some big temples. You know, he didn't want to just use the Indians, exploit them for their money. It was a way to participate in devotional service. Prabhupada made comments like that, be considered. Many of our life members in Bombay, advanced devotees, because they're doing so much service. Even other meat eaters. Still, because they were contributing so much, Prabhupada said, I consider them Vaishnavas. So Prabhupada had a vision, even from the beginning. He didn't reveal this whole plan for Varnashram until, in the later years, start talking about it. But the idea is, first we train, we try to train up perfect Vaishnavas. And that's beyond even the concept of a Brahman. Transcendental, super-worldly persons. But that's not so easy. Not everybody becomes a Paramahamsa overnight, we see, in practice. So the second thing is, at least we try to become Vaishnava Brahman, functioning as gentlemen. We are very civilized men and women. But that also runs into practical difficulties. Many devotees can't live up to that standard. And there are many other people who can't even begin the process, can't actually enter ISKCON, because they can't, take the vows and follow them. So we have a few thousand devotees. Millions of people would be interested if we made it possible for them to participate in their own way. That's the concept of Varnashram, is to open it up to a lot more people. To do that, even the devotees who are able to follow sadhana bhakti without falling down, they also should accept these material designations externally. We've already accepted the designations of ashram. You're dressed in white, Prabhu next to you is dressed in saffron. These are material designations. But, it's part of our spiritual life. We don't think twice about it, because Prabhupada taught it to us from the beginning. He taught a lot about the Varna system too, but to us it's theoretical, it's old history. Ancient times they used to be like this. But one reason why Prabhupada talked about it so much, how the Vedic social system was organized, because he ultimately wanted us to take it up also. Devotional service begins with dovetailing. Just chant Hare Krishna, be whatever you are, and the holy name and Krishna Prasadam and the association of devotees will purify you. But ultimately, devotional service is not meant just for dovetailing. We're supposed to be transformed into spiritual people. Part of that, according to my understanding, if anybody wants to debate it, we can, is to give up our material designations, our material conditioning. A lot of the problems we have in our personal lives and the society has in its collective life has to do with us being too much attached to our old material identities. Americans have their problems. The Americans and Europeans tend to be materialistic. They can slide back into sense gratification. We like to live lifestyles that are beyond the dreams of most of the people in the world. 300 million people in the world are usurping the vast majority of the Earth's resources. Most of the 5-6 billion people in the world can't live anywhere up to the standard we live, the opulence, extravagance that we live. Every time you flush the toilet, there's how many gallons of water? 50? Every time you take a shower, 100 gallons of water. A person living in the village here in India, it takes a bucket of water, 5 gallons maybe. In my town, they take a cup of water out in the fields. That's too much. It's too meager. But you can take a decent shower with 5 gallons of water. Why squander 100? And these little things in our lives, we take for granted, but we live very extravagantly. And therefore, we Europeans and Americans, we have a tendency to slide back into a life of sense gratification. But the Slavic devotees and the Indian devotees, they all have their own version of own kinds of maya that they, or conditioning, that they're not so eager to give up. Like Indians have a tendency to think that that they're because they're Indian, they're automatically very spiritually advanced, and the Westerners are all barbarians, and will never in this lifetime come to the standard. So this kind of prejudice is there. Each, no matter what our individual conditionings are, our collective national conditionings, they're holding us back from coming to the standard of Vedic civilization. All of us, we're barbarians, because this Kali Yuga is a barbarian age. Even the persons who can claim birth in Brahmin families in India, they're also very corrupt, most of them. So all this corruption is so rampant We have to give that up and learn how to behave like actual civilized persons. That is the standard of Vedic civilization. But Vedic civilization, the exploitive tendency is kept under control, it's minimized. And for the higher classes, one is expected to become very unselfish. You have to dedicate his life. Brahmins and Kshatriyas have to dedicate their lives to the service of society and the service of God. That is contrary, opposite to the whole concept of Western civilization. We have, democracy nowadays, which means everyone has an equal opportunity to try to exploit the resources. It's an open race for everybody. May the best man win. So it's so-called equality, just like we give the women their liberation, or they take their liberation. But it's liberation to be exploited, to be abused. So the women are not protected by their parents. The parents don't arrange marriages for them. They arrange their own marriages. It means they have to become prostitutes, sell their bodies to find a husband. That's freedom. That's equality. And the reality in the modern world is that a few people are winning the race, and everybody else, and most people, are simply working hard like cats and dogs, struggling to survive. And the person, the ones with the best cats and dogs, they get the majority of the resources. Vedic civilization is designed to work in the opposite direction, to minimize the involvement in sense gratification, and minimize the unnecessary squandering of Krishna's energy. So especially the Brahmins are meant to live a simple life, to avoid materialistic, unnecessary extravagance and opulence. As part of the Brahminical lifestyle is to be very simple. Even if most people can't do this, even if 95% of the persons who are in the modern world can't simply give up their lifestyles, if a small percentage lives a more ideal lifestyle, this will set an example for everybody else. And those who live a very simple life and are pure and are true to their vows, and therefore when they open their mouths what they say is trusted, those few people can lead everybody else. It's not that everybody has to become pure, but if some few become, then that can transform the society. If we get even one Paramahamsa can change the world. If we get perfect pure devotees, even one or two or three, they can very easily change the whole world. If that can't be done, the next best thing is to train up a class of Brahmins. And Prabhupada talked about that. He wants to make a class of Brahmins. These are the leaders of human society, progressive society. Okay, so we were discussing yesterday how to do that. We stopped in the middle. I don't know if anybody wants to pick up what they were saying. Continue what they were saying yesterday. Yes, Prabhu? Yes.
Yukta Vairagya. Yes,
Yes, many devotees, for some years, they're doing very nicely, using everything for Krishna, and doing nice and preaching, but then sometimes they just fall back into their old materialism, and spend the last 40 years of their life just making money for their families, which is not that a householder shouldn't make money for his family, but why give up our involvement in preaching? Why give up chanting 16 rounds a day in the name of making money? Yes. But for Vidyadesha Bhutana, it's natural. Human beings, conditioned souls, have a great tendency toward materialism. What is needed is, a few people who don't succumb, who remain, simple, honest, don't go back to materialism. They'll help guide the others. Not everybody, very few human beings could be completely self-motivated. They have to be directed by others.
So the vast majority of the population, the Vaishyas and the Shudras, to be frank, they have to be told what to do by the Brahmins and Kshatriyas. So this Vedic social system, it's not egalitarian. And the modern world can't tolerate that, that everyone isn't equal. But actually the Vedic system is, you know, aristocracy, that there's, you know, recognize that the higher classes who are a minority are superior, and their authority should be respected by the others. So with our modern world here, it's very hard to grasp that, to accept that. But yeah, that's the actual basis of the Vedic system. Some people are more spiritually advanced than others, more qualified to speak and be listened to. So nowadays we have this comm system, you know, internet, and anybody can have a say. Everyone's an equal authority, but that's not the Vedic system. The Vedic system is the person who knows best speaks and the others listen. Everybody just giving their own opinion is not of much value. Okay, but here we're dealing with Brahmins, so I'm opening up for discussion. Respected God brothers and God sisters, please, you know, give some ideas, because I'm a newcomer to this topic. I don't have much insight. Yeah.
Well, I thought that one of the problems with the discourse, let's say, that the foreigners are their own case, so like they have high responsibility down the person who gets the emergencies. And then another thing is that he's the last guest. Because it's less limited to fall sanctified to work. Or when it's only a guest, when it's not a guest according to his nature.
Yes.
He's called to engage a certain activity, for example, to do a fascia, collecting money by money his nature. And then he also gets a problem. And that is being properly engaged, and that is realized by Father Santana, the Brahmanas, they are able to see, and a man to see in others what proper engagement is, and the person can only be satisfied.
Yeah, the Brahmins diagnose, and to the best of their judgment, they help decide what's appropriate occupation. And the Kshatriyas oversee. To see that once the occupation is assigned, that everybody follows his own duty. You know, that this, the Kshatriya is the watchdog. To see that, you know, that everybody acts according to his own rules and regulations.
Because in this circle, he makes a strong point that the spiritual master, he knows the nature.
Which verse is that? 7,
Yes. Yes.
Yes. It's not that we don't have devotees who are competent to give such guidance, but we overload them with managerial responsibilities. The guru should be allowed to function as a Brahmin. He has enough to do. He has to guide his disciples and instruct everybody. The sannyasi, the guru, the Brahmin. Let others do the management. It should be organized like that. Yes, the functions should be separated. So our problem now is that practically nobody is free to just be a Brahmin. Not that we don't have those who can be Brahmins, but they're not allowed to be Brahmins, or the system doesn't allow them to be Brahmins. Yes?
Sometimes Brahmins
quit the GBC. Some do that. Yes?
Because they have been given to the system to act as a Brahmin.
Yes.
And
Okay. But I think also Brahmins have to organize. You know, brahminical voice has to be there to be heard. But unless you have one person who's so potent that everyone will listen to him, then a collective voice of Brahmins, you know, is the next practical solution. That means organization, not necessarily by the GBC. It can be done locally, small communities, you know, brahminical groups in different places locally should organize themselves, should, you know, form discussion groups. And if what they have to say is intelligent enough, devotees will listen.
I thought that was the purpose of the GBC. Sri Prabhupada.
Yes.
And of course, he was doing it all.
That's what Prabhupada wanted the GBC to be, to be a brahminical. Yes. But what happens is that the GBC is dealing with emergency management, you know, cleaning up disasters. Yeah. And so they can't function as Brahmins. They're too busy trying to clean up, you know, the messes from, you know, disasters. It's not even effective management. It's reactive management.
Yeah. There's been a serious lack of training in the secondary
levels. Yes. No training.
Yeah. And even the initiated group, one didn't really train themselves so much. I don't like them to be so much specific training. I mean, I'm not criticizing.
Yes.
But he didn't know the name, he gave me the general means.
Yes.
But it was, you know.
Well, one who is functioning, it's not a critique on, you know, what's going on, this is the way it should be. A guru should be free to give his attention to disciples. He should be able to dedicate his attention and time to that. It's a full-time job. It's a brahminical job to be a guru. And if you're busy managing too much, then how can you find the time? And maybe there should be more gurus so that you don't have to take so many disciples that you can't handle them. A guru should see that his disciples train up, if not by himself personally, at least arrange that somebody trains them up. Basic principles in Krishna consciousness. Yes. Please, yeah. Great news. So when we look at one thing you can see from that is those earlier leaders of our movement who fell down, you know, in one sense they're glorious because they sacrificed their own spiritual life for Prabhupada's mission. They took risks more than they could actually sustain, and they fell down. But that's self-sacrifice. You know, they're the pioneers. They built this movement. You know, so we shouldn't just push them aside. You know, they're the failures. Is that okay? Yeah.
I also thought that actually in case of Malta, which is also the temple presence to follow up. And if everything is laid out then, you can see laying everything down on the temple should be organized, the job descriptions for the different devotees. So I have everything in detail to work out how things come out.
Yes.
And often my personal experience and temple presence was just difficult to bring into practice. If there's not a minimal point, I have to fill the role of government and stuff the opposite.
Yeah, it is. The job has been defined theoretically, but you got to be given the, you got to be freed from having to do other things and be a temple president. And my experience being on brahminical boards in various temples, it usually doesn't work. Also, the temple authority has some devotee they can't handle, and they call on the brahmins to browbeat them to someone into submission. But that shouldn't be the purpose of a brahminical council, just to do the dirty work, you know, for the management that they can't do themselves.
And then there's a remarkable board who advised the GBC that we have an order in the chain that we receive the temple blessings.
Yes. As far as I know, I've been told that a combination of those two things is being discussed right now. You're having setting up a Brahminical advisory body that works directly with the GBC, and then below the GBC is a managerial council, and the GBC tries to get out of the business of directly managing as much as possible. It delegates all the problems that they normally deal with now to a lower body of managers. Global managers. Anyway, that's the thing they're talking about in theory. Okay. I think we brought up over and over again that what's needed is training, education. What kind of education? Any idea what can be done? One thing is, when you're defining educational programs, the first thing, what they tell you in textbooks on designing curriculum, first thing you have to define is what's the result you're trying to get. You take children or adults and you design an educational system for them. It makes no sense. You can design courses and do so many things, but first of all you have to define what kind of people you're trying to produce. What kind of change are you trying to impose on people? You put people in a black box, what are they supposed to be when they come out the other end of the box? So, that has to be discussed. If we're going to discuss how to organize education, we have to say, what are we trying to educate for? Yeah. Not everybody. Bring some, yeah.
Well, actually, you've got to really break it into two sections.
Okay.
Where you have your normal society, you also have the body of devotees and temple devotees. Because all the initiated devotees, they came from the normal society, they should have initiated.
Okay. Okay, somebody who can't follow the regular principles shouldn't live in the temple. Somebody who can't follow the regular principles shouldn't take initiation. Okay.
As a matter of fact, you have other ones, and they were actually able. Not only when they took their vows, they promised their spiritual master that they would do these
things. Yes.
But now they're not only falling back into material, they also lie, and they're causing great discomfort and problems to their spiritual master.
Yes. But, we have the case, many devotees who are sincere intend to follow their vows, after some years they run into problems. Someone may be a good brahmachari, finally decides, I have to get married, and then he gets married and falls into maya. Happens. But sincere devotees. Okay, then he was outside. Yes. And then he's lapsing on his vows, and he's in trouble. But
yes.
But what I've heard from Prabhupada in his explanations to his disciples on his ideas of Varnashram Dharma is that also the devotees who are following the principles, who are living in the temples, they should also accept these material roles to teach the others. The Varnashram system, Daivi Varnashram system, has to be organized by the pure devotees. And yes, and they should all be considered better than Brahmins. A Vaishnava who is following his vows. But still, someone may be a very strict sadhaka. He's been chanting Hare Krishna for 30 years, but he's got a passionate nature. He's an administrator, not a scholar. So he should do kshatriya work. It's like Dronacharya. He was a rishi, but he did the work of a warrior. Because he had that, warrior nature also. Yes. No, but he was. I mean, selling his Vaishya work. Yes, but he's Paramahamsa. Yes, he can be all everything at once. Most people can't do that without cracking. But it is selling is Vaishya work. So a transcendental personality can also do the work of a Vaishya, but it is the work of a Vaishya. And if someone has, the nature that all he likes to do and all he can do well is make money, that doesn't contradict that he's also, a first class or second class, Yes. So at the same time as we have our transcendental identities, we are, practicing sadhakas, strictly following our vows and our guru's instructions. At the same time, we can accept different roles in the Varna system. I can be a Vaishnav and do the work of a Shudra. You know, it doesn't contradict my being a Vaishnava. I'm just acting externally as a Shudra, doing the Shudra work. It doesn't make me a Shudra. Someone else who can't follow the regulations, we can engage actually as a Shudra. But the Vaishnava teaches how to be a Shudra by acting externally like a Shudra. Well, just like Prabhupada himself got on the floor and taught us how to clean the temple floor. You know? So he did the work of a Shudra. You know, just teach. The teacher can do the work of all the classes. The Brahman is the teacher, or the Vaishnava. But he should also act in the different material roles, especially according to his body and his mind's propensities. So, you know, it's not the fault of Islam if we have too much passion. Prabhupada built this movement on the basis of our passion. We utilize our passionate energies. And we should continue to utilize these passionate energies, but it has to be tempered. And we should cultivate some sattva too, to balance it, and to give it some cool-headed direction, that's all. It's just natural. Yeah. At the same time that we're engaged in pure devotional service, doing purely spiritual work, unless we're Haridas Thakur, we're also doing practical things. And we do whatever we do practically, our practical service, should be assigned according to the nature of our body and mind. Yes. Okay. But still, a person is not going to be sad. You know, he can, on his day off on Saturday, he can go out and pick potatoes. But a person isn't engaged according to his personal tendencies, he's not going to be satisfied. If a person is not engaged according to the disposition of his mind and body, if he's engaged in a totally incompatible way with his own nature, conditioned nature, then he won't be satisfied and peaceful. Yeah. Yes. 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 But anyway, the basic idea of Daiva Varnashram is by separating and designating separate functions of the four Varnas, even for practicing sadhakas, it makes it much, it facilitates the spiritual masters engaging their disciples properly. Okay.
Because the other situation is that Haridas Prabhu explained that the temple could actually include things like the spirit itself. You consider that the action, so if you look at yourself as a specific designation,
yes.
You consider yourself and consider your own, you know, still as a passionate material. Even if you consider yourself a knowledge of, you know, maybe the distinction is model of distinctions.
Yes. Yeah, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't identify with our material roles. That doesn't mean we don't play those material roles. You know, among Krishna's, when Krishna was present on the earth and when he was in Dwarka, among his most intimate devotees were the five Pandava brothers. Krishna was so attached to them, he left Vrindavan to go to Mathura and then take everybody from Mathura to Dwarka. He later would leave Dwarka to go visit the Pandavas. That's how attached he was to them. They were engaged, in materialist. They had material roles. They were engaged in politics, fighting their enemies. But it was Krishna's desire. It wasn't that Yudhishthira was, fighting for a kingdom. But it wasn't identifying that I want to be conqueror of the world. Uddhava explained to Krishna, Yudhishthira wants to perform this Rajasriya sacrifice, not because he's avaricious for power and prestige. Not because he wants to be the emperor for his own aggrandizement. But he wants to show, Uddhava explained to Krishna, Yudhishthira wants to show the world know, what's the benefit of being your devotee? He wants people to see the difference between how devotees are successful in their life compared to the non-devotees. That was Yudhisthira's motive. So he assumed a big material role, you know, conquer the world. But for the sake of glorifying Krishna's devotees. So we should take the material roles, but not identify with them, not assume material mentality.
Yes. And yeah, so you're right to say he's not a Shudra, but he's taking the role of a Shudra, that's all. Yes, Prabhu? Oh, sorry, Mother, yeah. He can do the work of the others, yeah. With limits. He should. What a Brahmin shouldn't do is become anybody's paid servant. He should try to avoid that. Okay, the question is, you know, isn't it that Brahmins are not at all inclined to act as Kshatriyas or be Kshatriyas? But not all Brahmins are the same. Not everybody is purely in the mode of goodness. So you have many Brahmins who have some passion in them too, especially passion in the brain. Yeah. You know, in Ayurveda, you learn about the different doshas, which represent the different modes of nature. And you've got your physical disposition, you also have a separate subtle body, mental disposition. So you can have pitta in your brain. You know, no physical passion, but you could have a very passionate intelligence. So some Brahmins are interested in politics. Now, because their passion is in their head and not in their body, they don't, you know, get into the fight directly. But they're behind the scenes as advisors, you know, as you know, ministers to the kings. So they have a sort of kshatriya mixed in their nature, you know, in tendencies to do kshatriya work. And then you have a few rare cases like Dronacharya, you know, who's a Brahmin by birth, son of a sage, very high, very elevated Brahmin, but he's got in him a strong, passionate streak. And he wanted all, you know, as a boy, he just had the urge. He had to learn military science. Ended up learning, you know, Karna. Well, Karna was a Kshatriya. But so you have sometimes, in rare cases, a Brahmin who's, you know, actually picking up arms and participating in fighting. Still a Brahmin. So it's mixed. You have mixed Brahmins who get involved in politics, mostly as advisors. Yes. Yes. Yes, and he's got higher education than a Kshatriya. And he's got control over his senses more than a Kshatriya. And he has, you know, stronger power of austerity. But then, you know, when you get near the borderline, it gets fuzzy. You know, who's a Brahmin and who's a Kshatriya? Yudhisthira was a Kshatriya, but he was a very Brahminical Kshatriya. And then you have a few Brahmins like Dronacharya. You know, he's nominally a Brahmin, but he's, you know, one of the biggest warriors. So it's a little fuzzy why Yudhishthira is a Kshatriya, not a Brahmin, why Drona is a Brahmin, not a Kshatriya. Yeah, well, he started off as a Kshatriya. And over the course of many thousands of years, he turned himself into a Brahmin by austerities.
Yes. He's saying that Krishna was not so keen that Varacharya went back to
okay. You know what everybody should do is aspire to a higher position. The Kshatriyas should try to gradually become Brahmins, if not in this lifetime, the next. You know, a Kshatriya who does his duty nicely, his reward can be that he can take birth as a Brahmin in his next life. But why do it the other way around? Why should Brahmins try to become Kshatriyas? That's unnatural. Yeah. It's not progress, it's evolution down. But anyway, Dronacharya and these other personalities, they appeared at the end of Dwarpa Yuga where everything was out of balance. There was too much passion in the world. Krishna himself had to come to balance the situation. So you had abnormalities appearing at that time. Strange births, various persons. Why don't we take a half hour now to continue a little bit, finishing up this encounter between Manu and Kardama. So we're up to verse 8. The Brahman and Kshatriya have properly greeted one another. They've acknowledged the other's valuable contribution to society. So now, with the proper introduction having been made, Manu can get down to business. So we read verse 8. Text 8. Sabhavan duriti duhutri sneha pariklishtat manomama shrutam arhasi dinasya shravitam kripaya mune. O great sage, graciously be pleased to listen to the prayer of my humble self, for my mind is troubled by affection for my daughter. Just as Kardama was honest and frank in his confession to Lord Vishnu that he had the desire to get married, although there was pleasant words being spoken at the beginning of the conversation, Manu now admits that he has an agenda also. He has some material need that needs to be satisfied. Having material desires is not condemned. The Vedic system provides that you can satisfy the needs of your body and mind. There's proper ways to do everything. So Manu can get his daughter married. Here's the proper time and place, the proper person to deal with, and he can make his request. He's concerned for his daughter. Natural. And in this situation, appropriate to discuss. He's talking with the right person. The person's a brahmachari, but he's not a brahmachari who's taken a vow of perpetual celibacy. And everybody knows. That's really nice. Thank you. Okay, I want one too. He knows. Okay. Thank you, Brad. Thank you. Everybody knows. that Kardama is looking for a wife. It's not secret. So it's appropriate that Madhu can approach him and make the offer. Text 9. Priyavato tanapadau swaseyam duhita mama anvichanti anvichati patim yuktam vayakshila gunadivihi. My daughter is the sister of Priyavrata and Uttanapada. She is seeking a suitable husband in terms of age, character, and good qualities. When material arrangements are made, everything should be done appropriately. The marriages should be arranged so that there's compatibility. The Brahmins are responsible for this, so this astrology is a political science. The sages who wrote the textbooks on astrology, they warn that if a non-Brahmin practices this science, he will go to hell and his customers will go to hell with him. The science is only for Brahmins, those who have very, very sharp intelligence in astrology. And the astrologers, among other services they perform, they match the young men and women appropriately so that the marriages are compatible. If they're not, then there's all sorts of trouble. The prospective wife should be have a similar nature to her husband, but she should not be superior in qualities. Doesn't work well for a marriage, in a Vedic marriage. If the woman is smarter or richer or from a better background than the husband. Yeah. Yeah, it just causes trouble. According to this, the human nature. Okay, verse 10. Yada tu bhavatakshila shruta rupa vayo gunan ashwino naradad esha twayasit krita nishchaya. The moment she heard from the sage Narada of your noble character, learning, beautiful appearance, youth and other virtues, she fixed her mind upon you. So Narada is again making trouble. He's very often stepping in and, you know, and telling people what's going on. Narada let the young princess know about Kardama, and proper young men and women in Vedic culture don't mix. They don't have an opportunity to meet one another. So the go-betweens have to inform the parents, here's the suitable groom for your daughter, and he's like this and that, because otherwise the girl would never find out. So here Narada is acting as the matchmaker. Yes. Yeah. I mean, generally young women don't want to marry old men. So this is, at least from the girl's point of view, this is a, you know, an advantageous quality. Okay, let me read 11. Tatpati chadvijadvimam shvadayo paritamaya sarva mananurupam te vihamedi shukarmasu. Therefore, please accept her, O chief of the Brahmanas, for I offer her with faith, and she is in every respect fit to be your wife and take charge of your household duties. Okay. This is the best kind of marriage arrangement, Brahma Vivaha. When the father, in good faith, offers the daughter as a gift to the suitable man. Prabhupada Okay. This is the best kind of marriage arrangement, Brahma Vivaha, when the father, in good faith, offers the daughter as a gift to the suitable man. The verse uses the word Grihamedi, which Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati and Prabhupada, following him, chose to designate the materialistic householders. You know, we have Grihastas, who are devotees, and Grihamedis, you know, who are entangled materialists. But actually, in ancient times, the word Grihamedi meant someone who was performing Vedic sacrifices in his home. A Vedic Brahmana is a Grihamedi. And they were householders. The sannyasis didn't perform fire sacrifices. Before you take vanaprastha or sannyas, there is the prajapatya ishti, sacrifice, in which you place the fire in your own body, into your abdomen. You merge it with the Vaishvanara fire. And that means you stop once you take vanaprastha and sannyas, you don't perform the Vedic sacrifice, the fire sacrifices anymore. So that's the domain of the householders. They're called Grihamedis. So that's ancient use of the word, but then in the purport, Prabhupada goes, again insists that there's a distinction, the Grihastas and the Grihamedis, and the Grihamedis and the Grihamedis. From the point of view of the Vaishnavas, yes, even the most pious Vedic Brahmin is a materialist. If he's not practicing Krishna consciousness, no matter how pukka a Brahmin he is, no matter how many soma sacrifices he's done, he's just a materialist. Yes, ma'am. Okay, so you're saying we shouldn't look at people, I guess you mean by people, you mean devotees. We shouldn't look at devotees' material designations. And therefore, even when we're arranging marriages, better we just let Krishna take control and just match up just anybody with anybody. But we've done that in the past, and it's been disastrous. I would strongly recommend, from my own experience, I don't mean just my own family life, but what I know of other devotees, and I was practicing astrology, and I did a couple of hundred devotee comparisons, and I stopped a number of marriages. I told them, look, this is just totally incompatible. And I saw other cases where they just went ahead, and it's, when there's a very incompatible match that shows up in the astrology, it usually turns into a mess. If this is a principle of Vedic culture, that the marriage should be arranged scientifically, it should be compatible, it shouldn't be a haphazard, it certainly shouldn't be just on the basis of sexual attraction. But it doesn't mean, then therefore, if we're going to take that out, it shouldn't be any basis, it just be random. No, not at all. It should be scientifically done. Okay, philosophically, men and women are basically incompatible anyway. Yeah. For them to actually, live together is very difficult, especially in Kali Yuga. For men and women to live together is very difficult. They have different natures. They think differently. They speak different languages. So better to minimize the risk of marriage by trying to find compatible couples, make it as compatible as possible. Don't just match everybody up haphazardly. You disagree?
Well, I was just trying to say that someone that doesn't
Yes. No. If we're on the Krishna conscious platform, then whatever material differences there are there will become totally insignificant. But to the extent that we're still in material consciousness, it's a psychological fact that men and women don't live together very easily. That's why in Vedic culture, even the husband and wife aren't constantly in one another's association. Yeah, because they have different natures. The women feel comfortable associating with other women more than with men, and vice versa. Is that controversial? That's just psychological reality. And devotees can transcend that. Yeah. But that's normal human nature. It doesn't mean, let's outlaw marriage. Most people will end up getting married. But there's inherent difficulty involved in the attempt for men and women to associate with one another. It's not easy. Because at the same time that it's difficult for men and women to live together peacefully, the sexual attraction is there. Now, so they gravitate to one another, even though it creates conflict. Anyway, if grihasthas live strictly according to the Vedic standards, or better than that, they strictly follow the regular principles of devotional service, then everything will be peaceful, despite the inherent material difficulties of family life. I mean, I'm talking very theoretically, but it's the way it is. This is Maya's arrangement, that we're attracted to what causes us confusion and pain. We're attracted to sense gratification, and whenever we indulge in sense gratification, it causes trouble. That's the way the material world is set up. It's the tricks of Maya. Okay. Yes, ma'am? Oh, no. Yes. Yeah, normally it is. And the astrologers are involved in it. It should be done scientifically. Yes?
It reminds me that I dwelt in the language of Rupa. Because of the religion of Rupa, wants to get into business to make money. So again, the girl of my son would preach.
Yes.
And he would travel in the lot. And his wife would always argue with him. He said, you're going to make so much money, so you can't preach. But he never had money. So then he made his assault with him, he would like his own best trip with me. So I am excited that in such a way. Even himself, he would get to make money.
Anyway, if men and women were perfectly compatible, then no one would ever want to take sannyas. Yeah, so marriages should be compatible, but not too compatible. From the spiritual point of view, they shouldn't be too compatible. Maybe 70%, but higher than 75%, then there could be too much attraction. Yeah, and then trouble. Aristotle said, by all means, get married. If you get a good wife, then you're fortunate. If not, you can always study philosophy. Not that we should follow Aristotle's instructions. Look at text 12. Ujitasya hi kamasya prativado na shashyate api nirmukta sangasya kamaratasya kim punaha. To deny an offering that has come of itself is not commendable, even for one absolutely free from all attachment, much less one addicted to sense pleasure. So here, Manu is entrapping Kardama. He's not going to be able to argue his way out of this. Now, make an excuse. that, you know, actually, I was thinking for 10,000 years I wanted to get married, but I'm changing my mind now, the last minute. So in order to prevent that, Manu is arguing that, you know you want this, you've been asking for it, and now that we're offering it to you freely, you have no excuse to refuse. To deny an offering that comes of itself is not commendable, even if you don't have any attachments. This is a free gift. You're supposed to carry out the order of Brahma, so here I'm helping you. What to speak of someone who's addicted to sense pleasure? You're not. You're a great rishi, but you have to set an example for other people. You don't want to show people how to be a false renunciant. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu talked like this with Raghunath Das Goswami. Raghunath Das was so renounced, Krishna's Kaviraj says, the attraction to sense gratification was never touched his tongue. He never had any interest in sense gratification his whole life. But he wanted to join Lord Chaitanya. He ran away from home so many times, and his father and uncle had him captured and brought back, kidnapped, to be deprogrammed over and over again. And he ran away again and found Lord Chaitanya. And Lord Chaitanya chastised him. Raghunath Das, perfect, most perfect renunciant that this modern world has ever seen. He told him, Markata Vairagya, na koro, Loka Dekaya. Don't be a monkey sannyasi just to make a cheap show to the public. Monkeys are living in the forest just like the sannyasis, but they're just doing monkey business. Indulging in illicit sex with all the she-monkeys. So, although Raghunath Das certainly was not in that category, he had no inclination to sense gratification. Don't let people get a wrong impression. I'm asking you, go home and satisfy your father and mother. And practice Krishna consciousness and patiently wait for Krishna's mercy. Of course, later Raghunath Das joined Lord Chaitanya. Later, he went to Vrindavan and spent 50 years, 47 years, something, years there at Radhakund and practiced, renunciation, austerity like no one else since then has been able to imitate. Krishna's Kaviraj says the regulative principles, the sadhana of Raghunath Das was like lines etched on a stone, carved into the stone. Can't be changed, can't deviate, impossible. And he was every day offering 2,000 obeisances to all many different Vaishnavas, offering prayers, chanting 3 lakhs of rounds every day. And performing great, great austerities, and living very, very austere life. So that person, Lord Chaitanya told him, don't make a cheap show, don't act like a monkey. So in the same way, if Krishna arranges that we have to accept some material position, even sense gratification, then we have to accept. If a spiritual master advises the disciple, although theoretically that's one order of the spiritual master, a brahmacharya can refuse the instruction to get married. Still, spiritual master may very wisely advise a disciple that this is, a change in your material position is beneficial for your spiritual life. Or vice versa. Tell another disciple you should take sannyas. That's the intelligence of the spiritual master to judge these things. But if you have material desire, Krishna, you can trust Krishna to make arrangements. Then when Krishna makes the arrangement, don't artificially reject Krishna's mercy and pretend to be better than you are. Now, artificial renunciation, trying to maintain a standard that you don't have the strength to maintain, can lead to fall down. So that, I think that's what Manu is telling Kardama here. Not telling Kardama that he's a materialist, but you've got some material desires. You're not completely free from material desire, otherwise you wouldn't have done what you've done and talked to Lord Vishnu the way you did, asking for a wife. So therefore, here's your bride, you should accept her. It's a strong argument. I don't think Kardama can get out of this. I don't know. No, it doesn't. No, we don't know that he knows that Manu knows that Kardama met Lord Vishnu. But apparently, a lot of people know that Kardama wanted to get married. Narada was going around talking about it. So he knew that Kardama wanted to get married. That much he knew. This appearance of Lord Vishnu was a private audience. I don't think everybody else found out about it. You know, Kardama is a real devotee. Even if he's not going to make a public spectacle of his personal realizations. You know, I saw Vishnu and he told me this and that. You know, that's a cheap devotee. That's business of a sahaja. You know, to make a public spectacle of his private realizations. Okay, verse 13. Okay, he's pushing his argument a little further here in verse 13. Ya udyatam anadvitya kinasha abhyachate kshiyate tadyashak spitam manas chavagyaya hataha. One who rejects an offering that comes of its own accord, but later begs a boon from a miser, then thus loses his widespread reputation, and his pride is humbled by the neglectful behavior of others. So, Prabhupada comments that Manu is the emperor, but he doesn't feel below his position to go to a poor beggar to offer his daughter. Prabhupada says Kardama doesn't have any worldly possessions. He's living in a hermitage. He doesn't have much in the material way to offer this girl. But he was advanced in culture. His consciousness and his cultured behavior was much more valuable than a big than a lot of money in the bank and any other material assets. This is recognized. In Vedic culture, the most valuable asset is your culture, is your character. That can't be bought with money. Prabhupada says, therefore, in offering one's daughter to a person, or in judging people in general, the culture and quality are counted as prominent, not wealth or any other material consideration. So Brahman is honored for his character. Kshatriya is honored for his strength, his power. Vaishya for his wealth. But Brahman doesn't need any wealth and doesn't need any power to establish his reputation. Okay. And one last verse. Text 14. Aham tva shrinavam vidvan vivahartam samudyatam atastvam upakurivana pratam prati grihaname. Swayambhuva Manu continued, O wise man, I have heard that you were prepared to marry. Please accept her hand, which is being offered to you by me,
since you have not taken a vow of perpetual celibacy?
So this also, Manu is aware, if you want to get your daughter married, you have to find some young man who's not married yet. So you'll have to go approach some brahmachari, but you have to be careful that the brahmachari that you're approaching intends to marry. Brahmachari life is meant for those who want to remain renounced their entire life. It's the brahmachari period of training is also meant for those who want to get married. One shouldn't marry without first being trained up as a brahmachari. So therefore, in the brahmachari order, we'll find both kinds. And we don't have different colors. One may not know himself, whether he's going to end up in which category. Whether you're going to be a brahmachari 40 years from now or not. Still, the practice is there. The training is the same for both. And then after, traditionally at the age of 25, the graduation ceremony, so to speak, and those who choose to go home and get married, they take their baths, snataka, those who, after 20 years of training in the Guru's ashram, they decide, okay, now I want to go out in the world and raise a family. They take the blessings of the Guru, they give him suitable dakshina. Dakshina should be given at the end of the education. If you pay the teacher in the beginning, then it's just a business deal. But the Vedic system is the student at graduation offers a gift to the Guru. And then those who want to get married, they get their blessings, take their bath, and go home. Those who want to stay, at that point they decide at the graduation time that they want to remain also renunciants. So they remain with the Guru, and eventually they go off and start their own ashrams. Okay, so now the offer has been made. It's up to Kardama to accept or not accept. That's the last section we'll read tomorrow. Any final comments?